Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the Jazz Joel podcast. My name is Ben Dowsett. I am here with Clint Johnson. Clint, you missed a week. We missed you. How have you been?
I've been okay. Felt hungover from missing the podcast, but I'm glad to be back, especially on this day of all days.
Yep, we are glad to have you back. We had a big day today. We were recording this on Thursday evening. The trade deadline passed just a few hours ago. Some interesting things happened. Maybe not so many interesting things for the Jazz. In fact, nothing happened for the Jazz today on this trade deadline day. We're going to talk about all things trade deadline, what this means going forward for the Jazz, some ins and outs, and our reactions to what happened. So I guess we'll start with that, Clint. Just a basic reaction from you, what you think about the Jazz's non-movement, and just your thoughts in general.
I have to confess that the Jazz's non-movement did surprise me. Last year, I was skeptical. I didn't think they'd make a move, but I did this season. And because of a number of different factors, and I assume that we'll talk about some of them, I really did believe that they would make a move largely to smooth out some of the rotation so that they could assess some of the younger players, specifically Cantor and maybe Burks, a little more thoroughly. And the fact that a move wasn't done really, really did surprise me, to be honest.
Okay, definitely. I'm in somewhat the same boat, although I will confess I was at least fairly convinced that Marvin Williams would at least generate some interest, and we didn't even really hear anything about him. I had thought that he might generate a little bit of buzz. His contract, as I had said on a previous podcast, is somewhat manageable. It's not as small as you'd like it to be, but yeah, the Jazz not deciding to do a whole lot, and it appears fairly obvious that they weren't really given anything to blow them away, and that would have had to be what would have happened, especially for any of their younger players.
Yeah, and nothing happened across the entire league that really blew anyone away. I mean, it was, a little bit of smoke, not much fire. I mean, if I had to say some winners, I like the Pacers getting Evan Turner and Lavoie Allen for Danny Granger in a second. Mm-hmm. I think the Bobcats had a sneaky good get in Gary Neal and Luke Ridnour by giving up Sessions and Jeff Adrian. I think that'll help them.
That could help them in their fight to get the seventh seed and lose to Miami. That could definitely help them.
That's exactly right. The Cavs decide that they're not going to blow things up by getting Spencer Hawes, giving up not much in Earl Clark, Henry Sims, and
that was an under the radar move to me. We can't spend too much time on this because we have lots of other good stuff to talk about, but I liked that one actually. Not a lot of people talked about it. The Cavs have been really maligned lately, just fired the GM. I actually think Hawes is not bad. I mean, he's bad defensively, but the rest of their whole team's bad defensively. What's the difference?
Right. He was the only player, I believe, with a better-than-average PER, a PER over 15. He was, I think, 15.4. So
really?
If you look at it that way, he was the best player that was moved at this trade deadline, which isn't saying much.
Well, and we may talk, if we have time at the end, we'll talk a little bit about just sort of some more league-wide stuff in terms of the trade deadline. For now, getting a little more specific in terms of just the Jazz, we wanted to sort of branching out a little bit from what happened today and how Jazz fans should maybe react to this in terms of the team's direction. What is your opinion on how what happened today and leading up to the trade deadline for the Jazz, how that communicates to fans what the Jazz's mission was? Is the top five draft pick that lots of people have been talking about anticipating, is that a priority? Has that been a priority all along? What's your opinion on that, Clint?
Well, I have to confess that I was skeptical that the Jazz top priority going to the season was a top five pick. I know a lot of fans wanted to believe that. I was always skeptical, and if anything, I think the lack of a move here says that was not their number one priority. I know that a lot of people were thinking they had to do whatever they could. They've already lost all these games. You have young players that are showing some potential, but it doesn't look like anybody's going to be that franchise-changing superstar. This is, supposedly the once-in-a-generation draft. They're in a position to possibly make a move at a top-five pick. A lot of people thought they just had to do it. And clearly, they didn't do anything today to try to make that happen, and given where they are, almost all projections have them with getting a pick somewhere between 6 and 10. I just don't think that that is their priority, even if it is the priority of many fans.
And so I guess that, as you say right at the end there, should it be? Given where the Jazz are this season, given the fact that something that you and I discussed before we got started, that the Jazz could have done several things already that wouldn't even necessarily be viewed as blatant T-wording, tanking. They could continue to start Cantor and give him more minutes and say, you know, we're playing the young guys. What's wrong with playing young guys? They could have done – there's several things in that vein that they maybe could have done to that, you know, slightly might have damaged the on-court product a little bit. We haven't seen them do that. Is that a little concerning to you? I'm torn on this, but I can – there are parts of me that maybe are. I don't think there's really ever been any realistic expectation of winning. And as unfortunate as it is, there's kind of this idea of if you're not going to win, then why not be as bad as possible? Well, do you think maybe the Jazz in their good tradition that they have of always being relevant, is that maybe a bit of a taboo thing for them, is to fully commit that hard?
I suspect that it is. Another thing is, I think a lot of people are taking for granted that this draft is loaded with kind of franchise-changing talents, and I don't think that that is as universally acknowledged as it was at the beginning of the year.
It may not be. I don't know. I'm one of those who still, especially in the case of Wiggins and to a point Embiid, I still think there's some special people here, and I think the draft is 7 to 12 deep in terms of players that at least could end up being franchise players. And just having the better selection of them is I think, of paramount value, especially if you could get a top four pick. The other one is Exum. We can't do too much time on this because we have some trade deadline stuff to discuss, but that's just one man's opinion.
Yeah, and I think that it's possible that the Jazz, number one priority has been to assess the talent that they already have on the team. I think the number two priority is just to always make smart moves, to accumulate more talent, to accumulate more assets, to not give anything up without getting something better. And this was a really tight trade market, and I just don't think that they were desperate enough to do any one strategy to give up players that they liked for something that they liked less.
Okay, and I think Marvin Williams is a really good example of that type of thing. Like we were talking about, they probably just didn't really get an offer quite good enough, and it's in a case of not wanting to give up an asset for below his value, regardless of whether it's an expiring. But that does bring into more sharper focus, I suppose, whether Marvin Williams is now, whether this signifies that he's going to be a future piece for the Jazz. We have seen in the past he's expressed the fact that he likes playing in Utah and a desire to potentially stay here in the future, clearly likes at least some part of what's going on here. Do you think that this is now a realistic possibility? Is that something that's been signaled by the Jazz keeping him on? And maybe should we be looking for a certain type of money figure for him? And what might his role be going forward?
I actually thought Marvin was going to be traded. And the fact that he hasn't been has me at the position now where I would be really surprised if he is not with the Jazz again next season. And the one way that I would look at it is the Jazz have already invested about $50 million in Derek Favors, so we can anticipate that he's going to be here. He's going to be playing alongside someone, and everyone believed that it was Enes Kanter, but if you look at the play on the court, it makes far more sense for that to be Marvin Williams, especially because Kanter, given a number three pick in the draft, how young he is, he does have exciting potential still. On his next contract, he's probably going to make substantially more than Marvin Williams. I think that you could get Marvin Williams for somewhere around the $5, $6 million next season. And he has played so much better with Derek Favors than Kanter has. It might make sense in all different aspects for the Jazz to pair Williams and Favors going forward and to look to leverage Enes Kanter into another asset that fits better with the pieces that they already have.
Well, I think there's no question that at least so far, Marvin, of course, he's been much, much better as a part of the starting lineup, both offensively and defensively. He's really, as we've talked about, revitalized his career from there. So I guess this leads us perfectly into another thing we were going to talk about is what does that do for Cancer? And we've mentioned it briefly. We haven't really talked about him as in depth lately. We've been doing a lot of focusing on my guy, Mr. Burks. But for Cancer, you know, he is a third overall pick, and if we don't sign him by the beginning of next season, he's going to be in the same situation as Hayward, where he will enter restricted free agency at the end of next season. What's the role for Cancer here? Are we going to continue to see him get kind of limited minutes because he's having a really hard time performing at a high level in extended minutes, or is it time now that we, you know, everything's set and we know that moves aren't being made, is it time for Cancer to maybe be getting on the court a little bit more so we can figure out what we have with him?
This is a really tough and pivotal question for me for the remainder of this season, and I think it puts Coach Corbin on a real difficult situation, because I think that he knows that if he plays Cantor and Favors substantial minutes together, assuming that Favors comes back from this back injury, I mean, who knows, he might be out for another 20 games because maybe it might be a convenient way to keep losing, but assuming that Favors comes back, I think Coach Corbin knows that playing Cantor and Favors together substantially decreases their chances of winning games, and Corbin has never shown any indication that he has anything but winning every single game that they possibly can on his mind. I don't see Cantor making the starting lineup with Favors healthy and with Williams healthy, and if he keeps coming off the bench, it's hard for me to see. He'd have to play really, really well, really consistently to earn back some of the confidence that I think that he's lost this season. It wouldn't surprise me if next season he's in a position somewhat similar to Hayward, in that he will believe that he is worth X dollar amount, and the Jazz, it wouldn't surprise me if they just completely call him on that and say, we do not agree.
Okay, and that was kind of be my next question, is that I don't at this point think that it's too early to start speculating about that sort of thing. If there's a player that simply cannot crack your starting lineup, even for a team that's not winning games, at what point do we consider whether that player's going to be a long-term part of the future? And from the front office perspective, how much time do they want to invest in making that decision? I think we have time to go into this just a little bit here. What do we think, if you're in the front office, what is your mandate for the year? What are you telling Ty when you're in a meeting with Ty and he says, well, what do you want me to do for the rest of this year? What are you saying to him?
If I were in that position, I would tell him I need plenty of footage of Favors and Cantor on the court together. I have to be able to assess those two players together. I don't care if Cantor doesn't end up starting, but somehow the rotations have to work so that those two players share the floor for a respectable number of minutes to close out this season, because I don't think I can make a decision based on what I've seen already. And then the other thing that I would be thinking, quite honestly, is Alec Burks looks like a piece to build around, and Enes Kanter has not looked like that. And so on draft night, I would be working the phones for everyone that may have an interest in Kanter, everywhere that he's played well, to see if we could package him with maybe the number 21, either to move up or to get another pick or to perhaps get a future pick or something like that, because at this point I don't see a lot of really good signs that Cantor is a key building block that will work with the rest of this team as it's currently built.
Definitely, and knowing the way that occasionally a draft pick or two can move around on draft night, I think I would agree with you. I think the priority would have to be to see if we can have a firm answer on Cantor by then, and so that way we can know if a good opportunity like that were to present itself, that we'd be in a position to either make that decision or say, no, we think that this guy can be an asset. Because as you say, I don't think there's any chance of Derek Favors going anywhere. He's been a little banged up recently, but overall for the season, he's been pretty much where he needs to be, and I think he's going to be sticking around. So we have just a few minutes left here, and I think I wanted to spend a little bit of time on just more of a, not even necessarily only associated with the Jazz, although today they're a perfect example of it. Plenty of other teams are as well, and the concept is a little bit more conservatism that we're starting to see around these trade deadlines. The Turner move right at the end that didn't even get reported until 30 minutes after the deadline had passed, that one spiced things up a little bit, and there were a couple of decent players, Hawes, like you said, who moved. But in general, I think people had maybe expected a bit more. There were, like Marvin Williams, there were plenty of his types around the league, expirings that we thought could move to contenders, varying different situations. And do you think that maybe the attitude, the new CBA or various other factors have kind of changed the way teams are looking at this trade deadline these days?
I think it's changing the way that teams are viewing everything these days. I mean, to kind of summarize what has happened this year as well as last year at the trade deadline, impact players really haven't been traded. And both seasons, a lot of people were predicting I can't even remember who it was. Someone from ESPN said that there was going to be that this was going to be an epic trade deadline. I mean, give me a break. There wasn't a single impact player. The Spencer Hawes has the highest PER of any player who was traded, and he's at 15.4. You know,
which
no
is just
first.
So just for reference, folks, 15 is average. So,
it is average, and he was, and that was the highest player efficiency rating of the 25 players who were traded. Not a single first-round pick, not even a high 20 pick was traded. No players with large salaries really got traded. I mean, the only player with multiple years on his contract who had made any amount whatsoever is basically Marcus Thornton, who's making something like $6 million next year. The hesitancy that teams have under this new CBA, they're so reluctant to take on money, they're so reluctant to take on additional years, and they prize the draft picks so much, both because I don't think that they want to give up a pick that may turn into a star or even a real contributor and have to answer to their fans, but also because the rookie contracts are so incredibly important in this age where if you incur luxury penalties in too many successive seasons, you get really slapped down by this new CBA.
The repeater tax, yeah. The repeater, yeah. If you're in 4 of 5 years, 4 years in a five-year span, you get slapped with an absolutely massive tax. So you did see some teams maybe trying to maneuver their way under that. Dealings in both ways. There were not a lot of it seemed like half the teams were trying to shed a little bit of salary and only bring back draft picks. And when everybody's trying to do that, it's not particularly easy for anybody to do that. I think one thing that's interesting with what you're saying is that you noted no first-round picks moved, a lot of silence generally. That wasn't actually the case this past offseason and up until now this season. As a couple people were noting in the Twitterverse, I believe 4 or 5, maybe even 6 first-round picks have been exchanged since the end of the year last year, or since the moratorium lifted last year. So clearly teams have tightened up on how they view first round picks, but there have been some of them moved, just not around the trade deadline. I think we're starting to see more things in the summer. Could this have anything to do with maybe teams exploring more possibilities in terms of sign-in trades over the summer? Expiring contracts and sign-in trades can potentially be valuable, or is this just kind of people following a league trend like we've seen?
I suspect that there's some of both. I mean, the sign-and-trade is an interesting option that was affected somewhat by the CBA, but I do think that there's still the potential for sign-and-trades to happen. I think that sometimes with the contracts that people don't want to just trade straight out for a sign-and-trade can be useful. Now, how useful that is for the Jazz could be debatable. I mean, what's your thought in that area?
In terms of the Jazz, and another one to mention along with that is a potential contract buyout. Again, for a team like the Jazz, it may end up, if they do something like that, and I think Biedrins would be the most likely candidate were that to happen.
I think Biedrins is really the only at all likely candidate in my
And
program.
Just really quickly, for those who don't know, a contract buyout is for players on veteran contracts. You can essentially, you're still, if I'm not mistaken, you're still paying them their contract, but then they just don't occupy a roster spot, and you can then fill their roster spot with, in the Jazz's case, it would likely be someone from the D League to give them maybe some spot minutes here or there in the NBA.
Right, and then if another team signs them, then both teams split the contract, or it's prorated.
I think so, but they can also clear waivers, and if they clear waivers, then they can be signed for a new contract by a team. And you'll see that a couple contending teams usually, like it's rumored the Clippers are going to be on the market this year for a big. Potentially on the buyout market. The Heat might look for a wing on the buyout market. There's certain teams that like to target those sort of things, but those are very typically contending teams that need just a piece or two to help shore up a weakness in some area. The Jazz, if they release somebody, that player could maybe end up with a contender at some point, but in terms of that actually helping the Jazz and them finding a player, it's pretty unrealistic. It probably won't happen. They've pretty much set themselves in terms of the roster they're going to be playing for this year.
Right, and if it did happen, and I think you mentioned this, it would only be to free up spot to kind of use the rest of the season to try out another young piece who, you know, they think might be able to flesh out the bench a little bit going forward.
Exactly, which I honestly wouldn't mind. I think that would be right along the same vein of being a little more experimental with some things. What's the difference if you lose a few games? They're really, and it could even be good. You never know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the way this season has been going, it really is difficult to know exactly what the Jazz are thinking. That's certainly true.
I will say, and you know, and hopefully not to be too bold with this or anything, but I would like to see. Maybe I'm sure we might not even hear about this if this happens, and that's fine. I would like, if I was Coach Corbin, I would like to hear specifically from the front office what they want for the remainder of this season, who they want to see, what the priority is for the year. And if their answer is clear, then I wouldn't even mind seeing some things drastically change. I wouldn't mind seeing Cantor getting a bunch more minutes, even though I know he hasn't been great. I wouldn't mind seeing Burks getting more minutes, specifically with the starters, because even if it's not to judge him, even if we already know he can play, we need to see how he can interact with these other guys. They're going to be the core going forward, or at least most of them are. I'd like to see that. I'd like to know kind of what the thoughts are in terms of how hard we should be riding veteran guys for minutes. Should we be really shooting hard to be in every game and things like that? These are things that are important. And for a team like in our situation, like it or not, that's how the NBA is today. So I guess that's just my personal opinion on that.
Yeah, well, I have no idea what the front office has told Coach Corbin, but one thing I can tell you is I don't know how to answer any of those.
Yeah, and it is a conundrum, especially like I said at the very start, for a franchise like the Jazz that has a tradition of winning and of relevance. And it's not easy for owners who have grown up with the, you know, a family tradition essentially of always being a competitive team to sort of throw in the towel intentionally. I think that's very hard for some people, and that's an admirable trait in and of itself. And the fact that this is that, you know, the Jazz aren't just able to pull a Philadelphia and just be blatantly horribly, horribly bad all the time speaks maybe to sort of the attitude of the city and to the ownership. And in a way that does make me happy to be a Jazz supporter.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. So I think that's a good place to end the Jazz jolt. Although in the 76ers' favor, they do own about half of the second-round picks in the upcoming draft.
We'll see if they can hit one of those into a rotation player. Anyway, yeah, Clint, thank you so much for joining me. We will be back next week. This is the Jazz Jolt Podcast signing off. Thanks, everyone.